So I want to ask you about, about SFU's responsibility for the environment of Burnaby Mountain. In what way does it need to be a steward?
Well, I think it's remarkable that it is taken until 21st century times for a sensibility to emerge within the academy on the mountain, that there is a link between our health and welfare and that of the mountain.
Oh, okay.
And Stephen Collis from the English department best articulates this. He was one of a small number of people who got, let's say, press during the latest phase of protests against Kinder Morgan. Mm-hmm. And what I like about Collis, I've been in, you know, graduate exams with him, is that he doesn't tackle things from a scientific perspective. Okay, I mean, he respects scientists, that's fair enough. But in his mind, it's a deeper issue of responsibility. Stewardship is perhaps the best way of describing it. And that's a relatively new concept among our colleagues.
Oh, that's interesting, because when I was doing background research for this project, I read an article by Sean Carriage on the history of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Don't know if you're familiar with him. And the parallels between Trans Mountains and SFU's evolving public narratives representing its relationship to the environment were really quite striking. And that was that from the environment as an engineering challenge to be overcome through ingenuity and technology, the instant university, to a more benign position of no harm, the university just up there at the top, to an active stewardship of preservation and protection. And Carriage suggests that the change in narrative for Trans Mountain came in response to changes in public awareness and concerns, so a little kind of PR.
Yeah.
In what ways have the principles guiding development on SFU land been internally driven by some moral sense of responsible stewardship, or externally driven by public opinion, including from its own faculty and students?
It's interesting that putting it that way, because it puts it in a much more general context. But one of the things this raises in my mind is an impression, thinking back over the years, that the faculty and the administration themselves are not particularly well connected on discussing these other issues. You mentioned this colleague in English, and I can think of one or two other colleagues here and there, but I don't know of any coordinated attempt on the part of the faculty to get themselves involved in it in any significant way. On the other hand, development has continued, proceeded, permits have been issued, the municipality has been involved in those. That whole development of university, they proudly boast of its sort of green conceptualization, including the construction of the, is it the kindergarten building up there?
Yes.
That is a completely self-sustaining environment. They don't need sort of outside resources brought in. They recycle everything, rather like UBC's been doing with one or two of its new buildings too. So that has been going on, but I don't know of a lot of faculty involvement or interest in that. That's been handled by the other side. So the green, the operationalization, if you like, the green concepts has been handled independently by the university development side rather than the academic side. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree.
Yeah.
However, there's a lot of discussion that goes on.
A lot of individuals.
A lot of individuals. For example, during one phase of this battle over the wilderness romantics claims on Burnaby Mountain, I think it was Jack Little pointed out that what's the alternative to building on the mountain? Let's go to the ALR and tear up farmland? Mm-hmm. That was a very strong, pragmatic argument and impressed people who were sort of sitting on the fence.
Because Burnaby Mountain was empty, as per the 1946 zoning map.
Right.
As far as individuals go, I mean, I'm from the geography department, so you would expect quite a lot of people to be interested in that. And there were, in the case of physical geographers in the earlier years, there was some actual research up there on the streams, and they built little dams and gauges and things like that. And I suppose produced some data. I don't know the complete story on that. But one colleague, Colin Crampton, who's unfortunately passed away now, used to walk up the mountain all the time, and he had a very intimate personal appreciation of... He was trained as a geologist, so he had a personal appreciation of the rock outfaces, faces where he could interpret the rocks and build on the existing generalized geology known for the area, but also the biogeography, if you like, the sort of secondary stands of woods that had grown up, also the climate during seasons of the year. And he wrote an essay on this and a lengthy discussion paper within the departmental internal papers, which is a couple of hundred pages long.
This is about the impact of SFU on...
No, it's about Burnaby Mountain. To the extent that
it's
Burnaby's impact
and...
comes into it, it's mentioned there.
Okay.
Now, that has recently come to light again. Nobody paid any attention to it. It must be 20 years ago that he wrote this. Nobody paid any attention to it for many years. But with the Kinder Morgan controversy recently... A retired colleague from physics, David Huntley, did look out this paper and found it, and he called me up about it, and our department has, in fact, digitized it now to make it available. It always was in the library, I expect, because those papers are supposed to be in the library, but I have my own copy anyway. And his judgment of the paper was that, of course, it's not a scholarly scientific thing, it's an impressionistic thing, but it shouldn't be ignored because it lays out a whole lot of observations which are not available anywhere else and in a reasonably coherent pattern. And Colin also followed that up by an essay in the Suburb of Happy Homes book.
Yes.
It's the last paper in that volume, which is an overview, and he talks about the way in which the air pulses around the mountain, and is an impressionistic notion. It's kind of an old-fashioned naturalist's essay on the mountain, and in that way it's very accessible to the public, which is what it was written for. So where did we start this little
We're talking about consciousness raising among the academy.
Yeah,
it has been a long learning curve for the Burnaby Mountain.
And that thing that Colin wrote is the only thing I know of that has been written as such.
Yeah, I talked to John Kirbyson. I don't know he was with the Parks Department and was involved in the creation of the first management plan for the conservation area in 1999. He took a master's degree in the resource management program that was fairly recent, I guess. And I asked him if Burnaby Mountain had ever come up in discussion during that course, or was it used as an example of resource management? And no, it wasn't the case, which I found very interesting because there it is right in their backyard. It is an issue, and yet it wasn't addressed.
It's interesting because I think in a lot of universities you would find this to be the case. People come from everywhere to a university because the university is a microcosm of worlds beyond the local, and they continue to bring that in so that the educational practices within the university are to inform the locality of the rest of the world. That's one of the things the universities at large do. And don't pay necessarily so much attention to the locality itself. On the other hand, I've also heard it said, and in some places individuals practice it with conviction, with field trips and that sort of thing, that universities should have a responsibility to tell the rest of the world about their own locality, which is, I think, the direction you're moving in your questions. So it's a yin and yang thing, but the overwhelming presence of the faculty, which control the tone of the discussion of the academic inquiry, for a new university is automatically that it's full of strangers. who are getting to know each other and getting to know the locality and don't have any connection to it and really don't know where to start, except they start living there and eventually it becomes part of their own existence. But by that time, they're probably retired before they do anything more about it.
Yes.
Did either of you ever trip across the firing range controversy?
Down at the bottom of the hill,
yeah,
on the north side.
Oh, there's
tell
one
me about
little
that.
Step in this contested terrain.
Good example.
There were two colleagues who cared about that. Gary Mauser, whose dude is a gun nut, and Elaine Bernard, a Trotskyist, who's now at Harvard, who, from a feminist, eco-feminist standpoint, believed in gun ownership and the right to use his rifle range. Well, of course, anybody connected with city planning, university development, town centers, etc., they wanted this rifle range gone. So there was a crushing consensus against it among the different elites. But there's an example of at least two people on the Hill were prepared to defend the right of the shooters to use the range.
And you know, that is an interesting, what I would term a conflict of use of the land. And the people that I've talked to so far have essentially ignored that as being of significance. But there was an example of a conflict in which we have moral devaluation, which made the conflict entirely impossible to find a solution. They just had to be kicked off. That was the solution. So tell me some more about that.
Well, they used to talk about it, and Gary in particular was on the email about it. It was in the early days of the faculty-wide email.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, that was many years later, too.
Yeah. it was in the era of the early 90s. You know, when the rubber really hit the road in terms of developmentalist issues. Yeah. Because the rifle range was clearly a relic of the old idea of an empty space, anything
goes. It was also established at a time when the road around the mountain was a very small access road. Now it's a highway. And so it was easy just to establish things here and there, and people would pull off the side of the road for parking. You can't do that anymore. And so it was a misfit in the land use situation. But where do you put such a thing?
Yeah, the development of Barnett Highway is an important...
That's an important issue. I was just going to raise the other point, that right there's a marine park right below there, below the refinery tanks. And I'm trying to think of the name of that little community, which was strongly unionized in its early years.
Cask Camp.
Cask Camp, but also wasn't there a village name?
Barnett.
Well, the Barnett Highway, of course, yes. Yeah. The village of Barnett. And that was an immigrant community, strongly Finnish. And it was you who told me,
yes,
Alan, that their early union meetings were actually conducted in Finnish. You had this whole sort of minor industrial small base, however, which still exists and prospers. On that side, on the north side of the mountain, well away from any other development of residential areas or anything like that, but it's part of the mountain in the round, so to speak, and that's a cliff face there because the mountain is an escarpment facing north. The cliff face faces north.